Welcome to the Michael Rivero What Really Happened radio program.
And aloha, America. Welcome to our show. It's Saturday here, and if you look out our little webcam through the window, the sun is just coming up here in Hawaii. And all the systems are running today. The chat room is open. Email is running. So if you want to contact us that way, you can. Otherwise, you can dial 800-259-9231. 800-259-9231. Jared is answering the phones and twiddling the dials in the control room. So pick up that phone, grab that that receiver, and pound on those buttons and call in and talk to us. We're going to be looking back, obviously, at the news from this last week, and once again, the economy continues to dominate the news. The Dow Jones Industrial Average had basically a down week, but there were some moments in there where it was just roller-coastering all over the place, and ended up basically clinging to the 7,000s with tattered and bloody fingernails. Now, about a week and a half ago, I oracleized that we were probably going to see the Dow into the 6,000s by the middle of March. I'm still standing by that prediction, but at the rate things are going, we may even get there a little bit earlier. And, you know, we're seeing Barack Obama get up there and speechify, talking about we're going to boldly do this and swiftly do that, and we're going to have swift boldness as we bold swiftliness through whatever he's talking about, and the plan keeps changing from one day to the next, and it's getting, he's had the job 1 month, and already it's getting very hard to take him at his word about anything. I'm going to go into that in a little more depth in just a little bit. But the bottom line is, here's what's wrong with the economy, and it's really very simple to understand, unless you work inside the Beltway. No one is hiring because no one is buying, because no one is working, because no one is hiring, because no one is buying, because no one is working. And basically what it has to do with, and we're going to go back, and I'm going to pound on this, because I am sick and tired of the corporate media scapegoating people who wanted to buy a home, and who basically were told by the mortgage lending professionals, yes, this is a good deal for you to get into. And they got into a terrible mortgage, but they were making the payments until the government changed the tax laws and created a financial incentive to offshore high-paying manufacturing jobs, and basically took away from Americans the means with which to pay their debt. And yet, we're supposed to blame those Americans. It's all their fault. They're not spending enough. Those selfish, traitorous, terrorist-loving, greedy people. They're not ripping open their mattresses and emptying their cookie jars and rushing to the store to spend their money on whatever they're supposed to be spending it on here. But the bottom line here is the mortgage borrowers, the home buyers, they're being made the patsies. They're being scapegoated here. They're trying to put the blame right on the home buyers. It's the mortgage professionals, the banks, the lenders. They're the ones who make the big bucks because they're supposed to be experts. They made the decisions to create these subprime mortgages and then peddle them. And we have found out, that a lot of these home buyers really did qualify for a regular mortgage, but they were pushed into the subprimes because the profit to the lending institution was going to be that much higher. So you want to think about that one. Meanwhile, we're getting a report from the FBI about an epidemic of mortgage fraud that has occurred since September 2004. That's how long this has been building. When they talk about all the subprime mortgages and variable rate and everything, it goes back for a few years, and the FBI is saying there has been an epidemic of mortgage fraud. 80% of those frauds are initiated by the mortgage lenders themselves. That is your problem. As far as the mortgage crisis is concerned, the problem is with the lending institutions, the very institutions that are lined up now to get a bailout from your tax money. They tried to cheat you once. It fell apart. Now they're going to the Congress and saying, we need more money from those taxpayers. Talk about a scam. Meanwhile, of course, they're still refusing to talk about the real problem, which is the derivatives. And that's where a lot of this money, about all this bailout, these trillions going, and the Federal Reserve has loaned out these trillions of dollars. And we're already seeing these institutions that are getting these so-called loans, they're not going to be able to pay them back, which means it gets added to the American taxpayer's bill. So The problem here is that the gambling casino of Wall Street ran up these trillions of dollars in debt, and they're trying to sort of fix the books. And here's the real big problem, getting back to that thing about the FBI reporting on all the fraud going in the mortgage lending industry. Over the last couple of months, we had Bernie Madoff, who basically confessed to his $50 billion pyramid scheme and blew the lid off the whole thing, because we learned from that the Securities Exchange Commission was turning a blind eye to what he was doing. You had Harry Markopoulos was there on a silver platter, gift wrapped with a bow, the evidence that something was wrong with Bernie Madoff's investment brokerage. And then now we had the Alan Stanford. His institution has collapsed. His investment group has collapsed. Some of his people are already under arrest. Now he's been linked to intelligence operations by the Central Intelligence Agency in Venezuela. So he's in trouble with that over there. Two more were arrested yesterday. And what I am beginning to suspect, and this ties in with the FBI report, that 80% of all mortgage fraud began with the mortgage companies. That as our nation lost its manufacturing and lost the ability to really earn new money, the financial institutions started sort of getting into these little gray areas of operation. And it probably began very simply enough, we hear this time and again, where an investment brokerage is coming up short on the money to pay their old investors. And so they say, well, okay, let's just take some of the money from the new investors just to square the books for now, and when the economy gets better, we'll fix it. We'll make it all right. But then the economy doesn't get better. And it gets worse, and now they're stuck because now they've committed a crime. And it's a small crime, but they're going to keep on playing the game in the hope that eventually the economy would turn around and real earnings and real profits would come in and they could fix the books. Didn't happen. And I think the reason the SEC turned a blind eye to Bernie Madoff and FINRA was turning a blind eye to the Stanford Group is because they know this is a widespread problem. A lot of them are doing it. Could even be a majority. Could even be close to all of them. Because look at all the billions of dollars these operators have been making. Where is it coming from? It's not coming from manufacturing and retail sales because we're importing everything from other countries. The bottom layer for this whole scam, maybe all these online trading brokerages that are getting millions and millions of Americans to come in and they sell it as a fashion accessory. Ooh, I'm cool. I'm trading stock on my iPhone. And they never talk about risk capital. They never talk about actual earnings. It's just a trendy, hip, fashionable thing to be doing stock trading on your phone. And you may be losing a little bit of money, but if they've got millions of Americans playing this game, that's where the money is coming in at the bottom, and it filters up to the top through this overlapping network of these pyramid schemes. And they probably would have let it go on, continue, if Bernie Madoff hadn't just come out and said, yeah, I was doing a pyramid scheme, and basically blew the whole thing wide open. And now we're finding out that all the government agencies who are supposed to be watching this weren't. Okay, we've got callers stacking up on the line here. I'm going to go to Chris in Tulsa. Chris, welcome to the show. We may have to hold you past the next commercial break, but what is on your mind today?
Well, I wanted to give a suggestion for all the listeners and for you if you haven't heard them. This actuary named called herself Smithy a few years ago recorded a series of financial information programs called Wizards of Money. You can find it online. I think somebody actually made transcripts of it as well as the original recording she did. And I think she was inspired after 2001 to record all this information down, kind of an insider's view of what's going on right now, of all the way it was set up then, how what could happen, and this is what would happen. So I find myself always suggesting this to people because I get into these arguments with people who are down on these downbeat, you know, these awful mortgage people. Why didn't they pay their bills? We wouldn't be in this problem. I'm like, no, it's the derivatives, just like you're saying.
Yeah, it's the derivatives. And the fact of the matter is, these people who bought these homes with these terrible mortgages, at the time they bought them, they could make the payments. They were fine until the tax laws were changed that made it financially advantageous for corporations to take the jobs away from them.
Well,
that's certainly not – yeah. So, the media is scapegoating the homeowners. They're going to make them the victims of the anger of the American people when it's the financial institutions that did it. Chris, stick around. We're going to be back after these words from our sponsors.
This is the GCN Radio Network.
What this country is coming to, I sure would like to know. If they don't do something, by and by, the rich will live and the poor will die. Doggone, I mean the panic is on.
And aloha, welcome back to the show. We're talking with Chris in Tulsa. And Chris, basically we were talking about the scapegoating of the mortgage borrowers, the subprime borrowers. They're being made the victims by the media, who wants to put the focus for the rage of Americans onto a scapegoat class, if you will, in order to divert it from the Wall Street bankers who basically turned our financial system into a casino and ran up the derivatives bill, and
right.
from the government whose policies allowed them and aided and abetted them in this crime.
Right. And the simple fact is, you know, one person, say my debt to you is your asset. If you've loaned that money to me at an interest rate, in the future, the, you know, $10,000 you loaned to me at whatever interest rate was going to be worth $10,000 plus this extra money. So then you're able to take that asset and use it as collateral for on another loan, leverage, or whatever. And those derivatives start lining up because, hey, this debt's going to be worth this much in the future. As long as these schmuckers keep playing their bills, we're going to have this money in the future. You loan me this, we're going to pay that. Well, suddenly all these people are going under. There's no jobs. They can't pay their bills. All these mortgages that have been slapped together and loaned off as stocks, or however they call them, mortgage-based securities, have now exploded. Now these bankers want full cash money value of their derivatives, and it's going to end up being over a quadrillion, several quadrillion dollars that never existed in the first place. It was just, hey, this money was going to exist in the future. If you would have just kept paying your bills, then I could have paid my bills, and they could have gotten their money.
Yeah, in a way, it's very much like that whole mark-to-market accounting method that Enron used to claim
exactly.
to the world that it was making all of this money, but it didn't really exist and it never did. The
exactly.
the problem with the derivatives, they're basically a multiplier or an exponent on what was presumed to be the worth of the underlying asset, the real estate. And as long as real estate prices continued to increase and new borrowers could be found to borrow money to buy that real estate, the system would go on working. Then we had that horrendous real estate froth up at the first part of the 2000s, the end of the 1990s, and you know, it just got really out of control, where people were buying a house in the morning and then selling it for twice the value at the end of the day. And it
right.
was great, because on paper there was all this newly created equity that became the money, if you will, to play the game a little bit further.
Right.
But the danger there is that, you know, when the real estate prices are going up, derivatives allowed you to make billions and millions of dollars. But as soon as the real estate market dropped, it comes back with you with a vengeance going the other direction. But you are correct about one thing. All of this money that is owed on the derivatives never existed to begin with. It's all paperwork, and it's all
right.
gambling losses. It's not like these people actually took money out of their pocket and put it on the table and said, you borrow it and you agree to pay it back. It's a spin
right.
of the roulette wheel.
What I learned from, like I said, what I learned from the Wizards of Money, she put things, all these complicated, exotic, esoteric terms, credit default, swap, caption, this and that. What are these things? Well, regulators don't even understand, because all of these things were created to get around the regulations that were put in place that stopped this type of behavior before. So
that's
these
exactly
more and more
right.
exotic things have been created. Now, I want to keep pushing it. Wizards of Money, because I don't think she's doing anymore. I haven't heard anything new from her in about 5 or 6 years. And
mm-hmm.
I want you to check it out, because if you can get past her accent, she's got like this New Zealand accent, and you know, make it through. She starts with where money comes from, how it's created, risk transfer, the idea of too big to fail. She goes into the whole idea of the, you know, the mythical lockbox. Then she goes
mm-hmm.
into the even more exotic stuff, and she applies the metaphors into pop culture, like the Star Wars metaphors with the imperial this and that and the banking clan. It just
okay.
makes so much sense, and it really responded. And I think a lot of your listeners and you might respond to it too, and because it helps put things into common language. Because their power over us is the obfuscation of the idea with their language that they use.
Oh, that's absolutely the case. I mean, most people don't understand that all money in circulation here in the United States is actually the proceeds of a loan. They still think it's money that a paper dollar is worth a dollar. No, it isn't. It's a promissory note that you will repay back to the Federal Reserve with future taxes. Okay, we're going to have to let you go, Chris, because we've got another caller on the line who's been waiting a very long time. Wizards of Money, I will track this down and put it up at whatreallyhappened.com, okay? All right, thanks a lot. That was Chris. We're going to switch to Renee in North Carolina. Aloha, Renee. Welcome back to the show. What's on your mind today?
Oh, kudos, Mike, because you are hitting the nail on the head. This is just a new version of the welfare Cadillac black woman being the source of all our troubles. They are telling us these poor people who took out mortgages are the problem. And you know what? Even the small amount, I'm taking bets on this, even the small amount that they say they're going to use to bail out people with these mortgages, it's small compared to what they're giving the bankers. I'll bet you very little of it reaches them because it's going to disappear the same way the money to rebuild Iraq disappeared.
Absolutely.
Mark my word.
Absolutely. No, we're into this grand looting of the Treasury right now. I mean, everybody's just, they're lining up, they're grabbing as much money and shoving it in their pockets as possible. And, you know, I've mentioned this before, I am not seeing the Obama administration do any of the things that are consistent with the long-term recovery of our economy. Everything is short-term patching and grabbing the money on the public till and shoving it at favored people. And, you know, from this, I'm deducing that Obama and the rest of the insiders have figured out they can't save it. So they're just going to loot everything they can while it's still running, and when it all falls apart, they'll skedaddle off to the Caymans and live high on the hog on what they've looted from the American people and leave the mess for us to clean up. Mm-hmm. And
they know if they tell people it's derivatives, people will look at each other and go, well, I don't have a derivative. Do you have a derivative? No, I don't even know what a derivative is. But you see, so many people have mortgages, and see, they want people to not be angry about this and take it out on them. So they have to, you know, they're always spreading that meme. Well, you know, this is all our fault. We spent too much. They want to sell us that so bad. But, you know, that was one thing. I could have kissed Bill Maher the other day because I think it was last Saturday. I think you even put it on your website with how he said, you know, all it would take was maybe to hang a couple of bankers with their you-know-what stuffed in their mouth, and this would stop.
No, he's absolutely correct. And, you know, the bottom line is if we had real leadership in Washington, D.C., which we don't, and Obama proved it this last week when he decided, when he announced that we're going to boycott Durban 2, if we had real leaders, the real leaders would say, okay, we need to separate what is the real money and the real obligations versus all of this manufactured fictional obligation. And we've just got to say, we can't deal with the manufactured fictional obligation. It may have been in violation of various laws. I mean, right now, if I were president, let's get hypothetical here. If I were president, with all of the fraud that is being detected and reported and exposed in the entire financial system, that would be the legal grounds to say, freeze everything as it is right now and say, okay, it is time to start writing off some of these manufactured debts. Okay, because
can you hold me over? I have one more point.
I'm going to hold you over one more time, so just stay there. We'll be back after these words from our sponsors. If you want to join us on the air, 800-259-9231, 800-259-9231. Jared is answering the phones, and we will be right back.
Listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
And Aloha, America. Welcome back. We're talking with Renee in North Carolina. We're talking about the scapegoating of the subprime mortgage borrowers. They're being made the victims for this economic downturn by the media. And as Renee was saying before we went to the commercial break, they're doing this because otherwise the American people are going to get angry with the financial system that created this mess and with the government that aided and abetted that crime. So we're all going to whoop on those home borrowers. And never mind the fact that it was the government that took their jobs and their means to pay away. We're not going to that would be impolite to mention that. So we're just going to all sneer collectively at those people who are losing their homes because, you know, they deserved it. They deserved all these bad things to happen to them, which it's a crock. We know it's a crock, and you know it's a crock. And it's like I was telling Patricia, who called in a couple of weeks ago, and she and her husband are living in this recreational vehicle. You did not do anything to deserve this. It was done to you. And I know there's a lot of people struggling, and just even here in Hawaii, we're seeing stores are closing and people are out of work and they can't find another job, and they are scared. And my message to them is, you didn't do anything. It was done to you.
And you
go ahead.
I really hope you consistently pound this drum, because even some people in this genre I hear this BS from. But if you'll notice, many of these Wall Street bigwigs like Bernie Madoff, mm-hmm. graduated from law school before
yes.
they went to Wall Street. And I think that what they did, they brought the same tricks to Wall Street that the lawyers use. You know how they write the laws in this legal pig Latin and hide it in thousands of pages of
yes.
double speak to where people throw their hands up and give up. The thing is, many of the same tricks are being used on Wall Street because this is free online at constitution.org. There was a Yale law professor named Fred Rodel that in the 1930s called the whole legal profession a racket. It's free online. It's called Woe
yes.
Unto You Lawyers, and it's fabulous. And the thing is, like I say, if you notice, most of those Wall Street people, lawyers, and what it is, they go to law school to learn how to be really good crooks and not get caught, and help write the laws with the loopholes so they can steal. And
that's
until
exactly
we have laws
correct.
That are short, concise, easily understood by the public, because it's not fair. What's the first thing they tell you if you accidentally break a law? Well, ignorance of the law is no excuse. But it's not fair when you write the laws where we can't understand them. They're thousands of pages long. They have enough laws that could fill the Superdome. If you had no job but to read all the laws, you couldn't do it in a lifetime. But we're expected to be able to be held accountable for everything that's written when they deliberately write it so we can't understand it and sneak all kind of stuff in there. That's just wrong.
Yeah, it absolutely is. But you see, it is done on purpose. It's done to conceal what they're doing from the general public. I mean, if the American people, if the law, especially the tax law, was written to be clearly and easily understood, there'd be a revolution by tomorrow morning. And like I said earlier in the show, a lot of people are still walking around with this idea that the money in your pocket is actually worth something, that it has an inherent worth. It doesn't. It's a unit of indebtedness. And it's not the monetary system this country was started with. You know, all of our problems basically go back to the founding of the Federal Reserve and the imposition of this debt-based monetary system on our country. And Woodrow Wilson, the president who signed the Federal Reserve Act into law as part of the price of becoming president, wrote in his own journals after the fact, "I have destroyed my own country." And yes, because of the size and sheer inertia of the United States, it took a long time for it to happen. And certainly the people who set up the Federal Reserve understood full well that the denouement was not going to happen within their own lifetime. So, hey, let's all be rich and have wonderful wild times today. It's somebody else's problem to fix way, way, way down the road. And I don't care about them because I'm the sort of individual who doesn't care about anybody else as long as I'm getting all the goodies and toys and play that I want in this life. And
thank you, Mike. And like I said, please, I hope just keep repeating this, so hopefully the repetition will sink in for people.
I absolutely will. That's going to be a major mainstay of this show, is my words of encouragement to those people who are losing their jobs and their businesses and their homes. You did not do anything wrong. You are caught up in the shrapnel, if you will, from an economic explosion that was created by an excess of greed blended in equal measure with abject stupidity and some extraordinary short-sightedness. And, I mean, even today, we're starting finally, I don't know if they read my website or not, we're starting finally to see some other financial writers write about the necessity of getting manufacturing back into this country, that we can't in reality do anything to fix the economy until we bring manufacturing back and are able to give people high-paying jobs. Now, that is going to take time, and that's why Barack Obama, he's out there, you know, trying to look good by taking college graduates and saying, here's a job shoveling in the potholes on the road. And I don't think it's going to go over as well as he'd like it to. But you know what you mentioned before about all the people on Wall Street being lawyers and bookkeepers and accountants, that's actually true of Washington, D.C. And that's why everything that we see coming out in terms of policy changes, it amounts to, let's see if we can do some creative bookkeeping to shovel the debt around and, you know, let's change the rules so the system can be gamed a little bit so the money, what money is left, flows the direction we want it to. But they're
so the
not...
Accountants also, that's, you know, that was probably one of the last groups of the professional class for me to catch on to. The accountants are in this up to their eyeballs.
Oh, yeah. Look what happened with Arthur Andersen following the Enron debacle. I actually did business with Andersen when I still lived in Los Angeles, and I had a business back there. Arthur Andersen was doing my bookkeeping for me, and they messed it up, I might add, now that they're gone. And, yeah, the accountants, they're in there. They're crafting the books to conform with the laws and in order to take care of the loopholes. And, again, this is why we lost so much of our manufacturing jobs over the years, especially the last 8 years. They changed the tax law to create this financial incentive for companies to send the jobs overseas. And that's when Americans stopped being able to make their mortgage payments. And that is why that's the initiating event. When you talk about a failure analysis, about a disaster, whether it's the Titanic or the Hindenburg or the Edsel or my first marriage, there's always an initiating event that kicks off a sequence of incidents that leads to the final catastrophe. And in this case, yes, our economy was fragile, but it was still salvageable at the time when the tax laws were changed to encourage corporations to send jobs overseas. That was the initiating event. Everything that has followed since then tracks back to that one point. The government doesn't want you thinking about that. That's why they're trying to blame the subprime mortgage holders, hoping that you'll go vandalize their cars and their tents where they're living instead of spray painting the homes of CEOs and politicians, which is what's actually happening, which, by the way, tells us that the American people are too smart to fall for this plan to scapegoat the mortgage borrowers as the villains in this economic downturn.
Well, keep educating them, Mike.
Doing my best.
Okay.
All right. Have a good day. Thanks a lot for the call, Renee. Okay. So, anyway, getting back to this whole situation, an interesting wrinkle, getting back to Swindler's List and the saga of Bernie Madoff with the loot and now Alan Stanford and these other two, Greenwood, and I'm forgetting the other name here. And, again, we're finding out that the official organs of government that were supposed to watch for abuses of the investment system, to control speculation, because we know from history that when the speculators take over from the investors, it is inevitable that we're going to see a disaster. It's happened in 1904, happened in 1929, it's happening now. So the government sets up these rules and these systems to try and make sure that the investors in Wall Street are just investing and not speculating. And as Renee says, they circumvent them. When we come back, I want to talk about the latest wrinkle in the Bernie Madoff saga. And it is going to absolutely curl your hair when you hear this. We'll be back after these words from our sponsors, 800-259-9231, 800-259-9231. We will be right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
You're listening to the Genesis Communications Network. And now, set your eyes on the future and let's consider what really happened.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to the show here. We're still talking about the economy. We're coming up to the end of hour number one of our two-hour radio extravaganza. And we are going to be covering a bunch of other stuff during hour number two. But for right now, I just want to finish up on Swindler's List. Normally, under the rules of the United States, it is considered a crime to receive stolen property. And while you are safe from prosecution, if it can be demonstrated that you did not know the property was stolen or you did not suspect the property was stolen, the reality is the property must be given back. If you go to the flea market and you buy a watch or a car stereo or a set of tires that turn out to be stolen, and the original owner is able to identify that property, the police will come and make you return it to them. Okay? Somebody sells you a car that turns out to be stolen, and they check it. They will take that car and give it back to its rightful owner. That is the way it normally works. Now, all of a sudden, okay, we are starting to see arguments come forward trying to explain why, in the case of Bernie Madoff's victims, not his victims, his beneficiaries, the people who got in on his pyramid scheme early on and made a huge amount of money, the arguments are now being put forward why they should be allowed to keep that money. And they're calling this a clawback. And just right there you see the spin already at work. That, oh, this is, ooh, it sounds so negative. A clawback. It sounds like it's a bad thing. Because the idea being that Bernie Madoff basically cheated a lot of his newer investors to make his older investors very, very rich. And they, you know, under the normal rules of law, they should give that money back as much as they're able to so it can go back to the people who got ripped off. Well, no. Now they're saying, oh, these poor, you know, these people who made millions of dollars off of Bernie Madoff's operation, they're really victims too, and they've already spent the money on living expenses and other things like that, and they should not be made to suffer. And I agree, it is unfortunate they're being made to suffer, but maybe a little more due diligence on their part was warranted. Especially looking at the stuff we're getting out of Harry Markopoulos, Bernie Madoff was making promises that were simply too good to be true. And so anybody who bought into his investment group early on to get those higher than reasonably possible earnings had to know something may not be on the up and up. But they turned a blind eye and they took their money and they walked away with it. And they didn't check things out. And yes, Bernie Madoff is a heck of a name. He's founder of, you know, the co-founder of the NASDAQ. You know, it's definitely a powerhouse name. But even powerhouse names, as Bernie himself has proven, cannot always be treated as trustworthy. Everybody's going to get hurt on this. But the reason I'm opposed to this idea that somehow we should let Bernie's early investors keep their ill-gotten gains is because that money has to be made up somewhere. And guess who they're turning to make up the losses for his later investors? They want taxpayer funds. No matter what has gone wrong in our economy, everybody's solution is, oh, we'll let the taxpayers cover it. Well, we, the taxpayers, we are taxed out. And we are tired of eating it for every bad choice and greedy bastard money grab that has occurred over the last three decades. And it just keeps piling on and piling on and piling on and piling on. All right. Enough with the economy for right now. I want to get on to Barack Obama, who's basically had his job as president for a month, but still doesn't seem to have really accepted that he has won the election and that he is the president, because he's still out there speechifying every single day and boldly this and swiftly that and swift boldness over here and as we boldly swiftifies and all the rest of it. Yesterday he got up there and he talked about how he's going to bring home our troops from Iraq by the end of August 2010, which was considerably sooner than had originally been talked about by the military, that said they had to have at least 23 months more to secure the ground. And yesterday I was saying, you know, guys, we cannot trust what Obama is saying because it changes from day to day to day to day. And sure enough, We are finding out today that Barack Obama is bringing some troops home from Iraq by August 2010, probably the ones whose tours of duty are up, but he plans to leave 50,000 American troops stationed in Iraq indefinitely. Forever. As long as you are willing to breed more soldiers, Obama's plan is to leave them in Iraq indefinitely. Now, Obama is saying that the troops are going to be there to protect U.S. interests. Okay? What interests do we have in Iraq? There were no weapons of mass destruction. Saddam is dead. Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11, and Iraq was not aiding al-Qaeda. It would be far cheaper for the United States to buy the oil than to try and steal it by force. So what are the U.S. interests in Iraq? Now, Iraq's prime minister said just today that the country's security forces have been tested and they are ready to take over from the Americans. In other words, Iraq's government, the government we put in there, is saying, you guys can go home. We're done. We don't need you. We're tired of you blowing up our sheep just for the laughs. Take your black water, take your depleted uranium, and go home. The Iraqi people want us out of there. The Americans, we want our kids back home. And yet, and Obama campaigned on a promise to end the war in Iraq. And yesterday he stood up in front of the TV cameras and said, yes, I'm bringing our troops home by August 2010. And then today, we're hearing, just sort of as a little parenthetical, oh, by the way, we're leaving these 50,000, and we're not going to call them combat troops. They're peacetime troops. They're enablers. They're advisors. Any of the other names that they can use to basically conceal the fact that, contrary to his campaign promise to end the war, we are going to continue to militarily occupy Iraq into the foreseeable future. And it is for this reason that, as far as I'm concerned, Barack Obama has already hosed his own credibility. In fact, I think he set a record here. I think George W. Bush waited at least 3 months before he totally cratered his own trustworthiness. So Obama may have set a new record. Now, one other thing that Barack Obama is talking about, he's talking about a new assault weapons ban. We had an assault weapon ban before that expired in the year 2004. Now, a couple of points. First of all, hang on a second. I had to sneeze there. I'm still fighting this flu bug. The assault weapon ban that we had before that expired in 2004 did not produce a marked decrease in crime on the streets for the very simple reason that assault weapons are rather large and cumbersome and difficult to conceal. And they're not actually used in ordinary street crime all that much. Yes, when there's one of these wonderful newsworthy incidents that the gun grabbers like to point to justify their desire for a totally disarmed American population, there'll be assault weapons shown there. But your average jack-in-the-box and 7-Eleven convenience stores, when they're held up with revolvers. They're held up with pistols. They're not held up with assault rifles. But by golly, we're going to get those assault weapons off the street. Now, recently, of course, the Supreme Court has confirmed that the right to keep and bear arms is an individual right guaranteed by the Constitution. And if you read the Second Amendment, where it talks about the security of a free state, it is obvious that military arms are what is being guaranteed to the people to own and to keep. As Jefferson himself said, to hold a tyrannical government in check. Now, needless to say, Obama's announcement, maybe this is part of his economic stimulus, because Obama's announcement to seek a new assault weapons ban has lit up the American gun industry. They can't keep them in the stores long enough. They're unloading, they're selling them right off the back of the truck. We've had gun store owners who are closing their store so they can get caught up on all the paperwork that is piling up from these gun purchases between the waiting day and the registration and the criminal background check and all the rest of it. But Americans are buying assault-style weapons, and for a very good reason. We all know a crisis is coming. Okay, that's the end of hour number one. When we come back, we're going to be talking more about what's going on with the economy. We're going to be talking about Ryanair and Bill Maher and bloggers and all the rest of it. So we're going to stop for some news. We'll be back in about 7 minutes. Until then, aloha, America.
Welcome to the Michael Rivero What Really Happened radio program.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to our show, hour number two. A shout out to all of the affiliates who are joining us for the second hour. And a special shout out to Radio Free Oklahoma, 107.1 FM, Oklahoma City, who has become part of the What Really Happened Ohana. Now, obviously, during the first hour, we spent a great deal of time on the economy. I'm not going to do that much of the economy this time because there's a lot of other stuff going on here. I do want to start. This is going to sound like a very almost trivial subject to begin with, but I want to start with Ryanair, which is this very low-budget airline. And I've flown on them myself when there was absolutely positively no other way to get where I was going. And this last week, they raised a few eyebrows by coming forward with a suggestion that they are going to put coin slots on the toilet facilities of their airplanes. So if you are at 30,000 feet, trapped inside a pressurized cabin, and you have to go, you will have to pay to use the toilet over and above what you've already paid for your airplane ticket. This, needless to say, did not go over very well with a lot of people. And who knows, maybe William Shatner over at Priceline is throwing a hissy fit and saying, we can't deal with these people anymore. But you would think with such an embarrassment fresh in everybody's mind that Ryanair might want to be presenting a more cooperative, agreeable face to the public. Didn't actually work. Apparently, Ryanair has a website, and a very smart computer engineer noticed that Ryanair's online booking system had a software bug, which actually allowed you to book a ticket and buy it for $0.00. Now, I know Ryanair is the low-cost air travel alternative, but I don't think they intended to go quite that low cost. So this computer engineer, as a professional courtesy, went to the blog section and said, you have a small problem with your website, and here it is, and here's what you should do to fix it. And rather than acknowledge, thank you very much for helping us deal with these issues in these times where hackers are running amok all over the internet. The individual who was posting from Ryanair's headquarters, and they did confirm that the message traffic was coming from Ryanair's corporate headquarters, the person posting from Ryan got defensive and said, our website is perfect, you don't know what you're talking about, and just escalated the situation to the point where it attracted the attention of some corporate media and succeeded in blackening Ryanair's public relations eye just a little bit deeper than the toilet fiasco had. Well, apparently Ryanair does not have the wisdom that it takes to understand you should not raise on a busted flush, because Ryanair's response was, well, we're not going to waste any more time blogging online anyway, and proceeded to call bloggers lunatics and said they can have the blog space, we're not interested anymore, and just walk off with this very kind of sulking attitude, dissing the online bloggers, in particular this one individual whose only desire had been, as a courtesy, to say, you've got a bug that allows people to buy tickets for $0.00. Maybe if you clean that problem up, you won't have to charge to use the toilet in flight. And this, of course, is symptomatic. We're seeing more and more corporations and more corporate media especially get on the case of the blogs and bloggers and try and insult them and deride them over and over again. And Bill Maher, who I normally like most of what he does, and especially his comment a couple of weeks ago about hanging a few bankers to stop the runaway greed in Wall Street. I think that was a cogent observation. But last night, Bill Maher decided to rip into the blogosphere as he was talking about the closing of the San Francisco Chronicle, the Rocky Mountain News, Philadelphia Inquirer, the Daily News, and basically accused the bloggers of stealing information and then pulling excrement out of their derriere. I'm cleaning this up for the benefit of the FCC people who listen in on this thing. Now, I understand there's a lot of news aggregation going on in the blogs, but under the fair use provisions of the Copyright Act, bloggers are allowed to refer to other material in order to make commentary and in order to show by a preponderance of overlapping stories that certain information is factually true. Now, the real issue is, yes, the blogs are taking the audience away from the newspapers, and those newspapers that developed online editions are losing the audience online to the blogs. And the reason is very simple, and it has to do with that, what Mara is calling excrement pulled out of their derriere. Because the reason the blogs are taking their audience, the reason the blogs are becoming at least numerically a success, if not financial powerhouses, is because we are pointing out where the government is lying to the people and where corporations are cheating you. Those are functions that, at least when I took a journalism class in college, we were taught the media was supposed to do. That the reason the founding fathers had given the First Amendment to the public regarding freedom of speech was so that the newspapers of the time, as Ben Franklin's had, point to what the government was doing that was wrong. Now, everyone likes to talk about First Amendment covering art and movies and paintings on the wall with bovine excrement stuck to it and all the rest of it, and that's a secondary issue. The particular speech that was being discussed by the Founding Fathers in the First Amendment was political speech, that people had a right to say the government is wrong and here is why. And the newspapers in the early days saw their role as a watchdog on government abuse. That if the government was doing something wrong, we could count on the media to point that out to us. Now, the problem with the media is they have completely abandoned that role. When George Bush got up there and talked about Iraq buying yellowcake uranium from Niger, not one of the major network media TV news shows or the major corporate newspapers questioned the claim at all, even though the IAEA had already decided that the documents in question were not only forgeries, they were very clumsy forgeries. The Italian Parliament had investigated and named Michael Ledeen as one of the forgers. I mean, the documents just did not stand up to investigation. They had an outdated letterhead on it. The person who supposedly signed the agreement on the Niger side had not held that position for many, many years. It just went on and on. Any serious investigative reporter would have found all of these facts and said, I think George Bush just lied in the State of the Union address. But none of those major corporate media institutions did that. Why? Well, the investigative journalism is all now being done by the blogs. And yes, we're pointing to the stories in the corporate mainstream media in order to substantiate specific facts that we then comment on to say, okay, the media is saying this, but here is what's really going on. And the media is actually kind of left-handed admitting it when they report on this fact over here. So the reality is, let's just go right down the list here. When Bush was saying Saddam had nuclear weapons, it was the blogs who said, no, he doesn't. It's a lie. When the media and was screaming that the anthrax letters were from some Arabs in the Middle East, it was the blogs who said, no, it's closer to home. We're finding, you know, there's too many things wrong with this thing. There's 9/11 itself. The media was there hand in glove with the government saying, Osama bin Laden, Osama bin Laden, Osama bin Laden. It's the blogs that pointed out the BBC reported the collapse of World Trade Center 7 before it actually happened. It was the blogs that put out there the fact that Israelis were arrested on 9/11, cheering and dancing and high-fiving each other. So the reason we're taking the audience away from the newspapers and the TV networks is because people want the truth, and they're going to go where the truth is. And if the newspapers were going to tell you the truth, if the TV network news shows would tell you the truth, the blogs would never, ever have taken off. We would not need to be here. I, for one, would not be here if the media would tell the truth. But as long as the newspapers are going to lie to you, yeah, we're going to drive them out of business because liars should be driven out of business. We'll be back after these words from our sponsors.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Some are maxed out all their credit cards. Some are working two jobs and living in cars. Minimum wage won't pay for a roof, won't pay for a drink. If you gotta have proof, distract yourself, Mr. CEO. See how far 5:15 an hour will go. Take a part-time job at one of your stores. I bet you can't make it here anymore.
And aloha, America. And yeah, more and more people are finding they can't make it here anymore. The system is broken, and the people in charge just seem to be perfectly happy to let it all collapse and break apart, and they're going to pick up the really nice pieces and put it in their pocket and leave the rest of the rubble behind for us to deal with. Now, when Barack Obama became president a month ago, he's had the job about a month, he had a press conference, his first as president, and Helen Thomas, who is an icon in the White House press corps, she has been interviewing presidents forever. No, it's not true that she and Thomas Jefferson had a fling in their youth. She's not quite that old. But she is definitely an icon in Washington, D.C. Probably she knows as much about running the government as anybody else in there. And she asked Barack Obama a direct question. She said, what countries in the Middle East have nuclear weapons? And Barack Obama evaded the question. And he didn't say that anybody did or did not. He got off on this thing about we are not going to permit an arms race in the Middle East. And there was a very specific reason that Obama did this evasion. Under United States law, specifically the Symington Act, I think, of 1974, it is illegal for the United States to send military or financial aid to any country trafficking in nuclear materials or engaged in nuclear research that is not a signer of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And so one of the reasons for Israel's policy of nuclear ambiguity regarding nuclear weapons, maybe we have them and maybe we don't. We have them when we need to threaten the Arabs, but we don't have them when we need to deal with the United States of America, because the instant Israel officially acknowledges having nuclear weapons, and the U.S. officially acknowledges Israel officially acknowledging having nuclear weapons, then the United States is prohibited under U.S. law from sending Israel any more money or any more weapons or any more supplies of any of a military nature. That is U.S. law. Now, earlier today, and I just put it up on whatreallyhappened.com, somebody sent me this interesting map. It's a map of the world's reactors, not bomb sites. A map of the world's nuclear reactors. And I took a look at it, and sure enough, Israel is completely blank. And that is not accurate, because we know that Israel has at least one nuclear reactor at Dimona. It's considered a research facility. It is also, as Mordecai Vanunu proved, where Israel builds its more recent nuclear weapons, that there is, in fact, a clandestine weapons lab underneath the Dimona facility, which is why Israel's always going around accusing everybody else of having clandestine weapons facilities under their power stations. And you'll remember when Iraq bombed, when Israel bombed Iraq's power station at the Ulsterich reactor complex. And then after the invasion of 2003, international experts went in and took a look, and by golly, it was a power station. And there was no sign of a clandestine weapon laboratory. And even now we're hearing, you know, Israel is leading the charge to say Iran is building nuclear bombs in their power station, even though the IAEA says they're not. There's no evidence of diversion. There's no evidence of excessive enrichment. There's none of the, you know, engineering facilities that are required to build the bomb casing itself. Just having the uranium is not a bomb. You've got to build a machine, a complex, very difficult to produce machine, to make it go boom at the appropriate time and place. And there's no evidence of that at all. And then it occurred to me, here's the reason that reactor is not on the map, the world map, the Israeli reactor. Because it isn't whether or not Israel has nuclear weapons that brings the Symington Act into force. It is whether they're working with nuclear materials at all outside of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And we've got satellite photos of that reactor complex. I put one up in association with that story. So it's no longer acceptable for the U.S. government to be sending money to Israel by pretending Israel doesn't have nuclear weapons. That's not the spirit and intent of the law. We're not supposed to be sending material aid or financial aid to any country that's dealing with nuclear technology outside the safeguards of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And Barack Obama is smart enough to know this. And together with yesterday's announcement that the Obama administration plans to boycott the United Nations Durban Conference on Racism, Durban 2, I think it's just becoming more and more clear that the last election in November was irrelevant, that there is no change, that once again we have a government which is totally subservient to the will of Israel. And I don't know why. Maybe Israel's got a bunch of their nuclear bombs planted underneath their capital cities or something. Or maybe they've got compromising negatives on everybody in the power structure. Certainly they've got enough money to buy and bribe most of our government, and they openly do it. You know, another case is this AIPAC spy case. This has been going on for years now. And the courts keep literally trying to throw the fight to these Israeli spies. And we've reached the point where today they're saying in the press that the prosecutors may just drop the case, because they can't get the judge to let them do anything to prove that these guys were engaged in this revealing of classified information. And the utter absurdity of it now is that AIPAC is saying that AIPAC should decide whether or not this information should have been classified or not. It's not up to the United States anymore to say this is classified, this isn't. AIPAC's defense of their former employees is, well, this information shouldn't have been classified, therefore they didn't actually commit a crime. And it just gets more and more absurd. I mean, our economy is hovering on the edge of collapse, and we're still sending billions of dollars to Israel. That recent incursion into Gaza, where they're dropping flaming white-hot phosphorus on Gaza school kids. We paid for the phosphorus. It was actually, those shells were made in the United States. When they found the remains of the shells at these various UN facilities and schools, they're still stamped with the numbers from the U.S. companies that made them. And now the U.S. is on the hook to send money in to Gaza to clean the mess up, which probably most of it will not reach the Gazans. It'll be like the Iraq reconstruction. We, the American people, get to pay billions of dollars to invade Iraq and smash the heck out of it. And then we get to pay billions of dollars more to reconstruct it. And most of that money vanished. Billions of it vanished. And they're investigating the top U.S. military commanders in Iraq. They just made off with the money. Pallets, literally pallets on forklift, pallets of $100 bills. That's how much money on your tab they were throwing into this. It's whatever the government does, you'll be forced to pay for it, no matter how stupid and dumb and destructive and self-contradictory it is. You will be forced to pay for it. We're going to take a break here. If you want to join us on the air, 800-259-9231, 800-259-9231. We will be back after these words from our sponsors.
This is the GCN Radio Network.
We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down in Gaza tonight.
Aloha, America. Welcome back to the show. And we're going to cover a couple of lighter stories. We're going to get away from all the heavy and serious stuff, because I know it can be a little bit daunting, and people just get overwhelmed by all the stuff that is going on here. Now, we've all seen that TV commercial that Microsoft put out called Mojave. And basically, this was a rather lame attempt to recover from the damage of the Vista operating system, which I think just won an award for like the total flop of the year or something. I read that yesterday. I forget the exact name of the award, but that was the context. It was basically the all-time tech mess up of some period of time. Anyway, so Microsoft has this commercial. And they have a bunch of computer users who are coming in and they're saying, we want to show you this new operating system that's called Mojave. And they demonstrate it, and these computer users go, ooh, ah, it's wonderful. And then the guy says, surprise, it's really Vista. And they go, oh, it's Vista, how wonderful. I guess it really must be something wonderful after all. Now, first of all, it's obvious that the people in that room looking at the computer are not really experienced computer users, or they probably would have realized they were looking at Vista. But somebody did this wonderful parody of a commercial, and it's basically the same kind of context where these computer users are brought into this room and shown this computer operating interface system and all the wonderful things it'll do, and they're told it's the new version of Vista. And the people say, ooh, ah, it's wonderful, I want to buy it. And it's a Linux box. So I just thought that was so wonderful because Microsoft's marketing strategy has blown back on them because, I mean, if you're a real old Unix guru like I am, you know, it's all command line interfaces and stuff. But the newer versions of Linux, and I do have SUSE Linux running on some of the machines around here, it actually has caught up with what is desired by consumers of computer equipment. It's nice interfaces. And a little bit less of the security headaches because the hackers prefer going to Windows because most people have it. And the bottom line is you can get into the Linux box and you can get right down and talk to the bare metal and you can go in and fix things yourself. It's not all locked away from you with all this digital rights management and security code this and license that. You can basically, that's the thing I love most about Linux. You can get in there and you can sling the code yourself and just make things work. And that really is why it's such a popular operating system, that plus its universality. Anyway, getting a little bit further on here, I'm going to take a shot here at some of our global warming cultists who have been pummeling me in my mailbox this last week because of some of the stories I'm running. One of the so-called catastrophic results of global warming, always waved about by the cultists, is the melting of the ice sheets covering Greenland. And there had been claims that Greenland had been pushed past a tipping point in to this epidemic of ice loss and rapidly rising sea levels. And it was this doom and gloom scenario. And there was a little bit of a pullback of the Greenland ice sheet about 3-4 years ago, and they found, much to their surprise, as the ice receded, they were seeing archaeological signs of human habitation, which basically tells us that Greenland was once a lot warmer than it is today, and that people lived there, and they farmed there, and they had churches and so forth, and it's still there. And then it got colder, and they left. Well, apparently, from the fall meeting of the American Geophysical Union, basically they're saying, never mind, the disastrous ice reduction that we had all been worried about isn't happening. And this is more of that continued fallout from the satellite data and sensor failure, which produced a result that the global warming cultists really loved, that the Arctic ice sheet was receding drastically and it was all open ocean, and they were talking about there was going to be open water at the North Pole. And then come to find out the data collection equipment was wrong, and that they had actually, there was a lot more ice there that simply was not being detected. It was being reported as really cold water, but not as ice. And I think the point here is, without saying global warming is nonsense and global warming is gospel, I think these incidents of the satellite data failure, and certainly the fact that some of the temperature sensors cited by the cult are located in some very questionable places, like the outflow from air conditioning. And I've got a photo on my website of one of these temperature measuring stations sitting right next to a trash incinerator. Gee, I wonder if they got warmer temperatures out of that one. The bottom line here, I think, is it's safe to say is that we don't actually really know. Everybody has some data they say proves their particular point of view, but there is so much doubt about the validity of the data itself. And we need to remember that scientific method exists because of the recognition that individual scientists are just as prone to bias, prejudice, religious belief, financial inducement as any other member of society. And the whole point of scientific method was to have a process by which information could be brought forward and vetted in a way that took human failings out of it. And so you can, if you have enough money, hire a scientist to stand up and say pretty much anything you want to. I remember not too long ago there was a candy company was able to hire some scientists that say, yes, having a candy bar for lunch was sound nutritional policy, that it was good for you, and that was a great way to build up your energy and lose weight at the same time. A candy bar, you know, sugar. Big block of sugar for lunch was sound nutritional advice. And it was ludicrous, and the advertising agency pulled the spots. But the bottom line is, individual scientists can be bought. They can be prejudiced. They can so want to see what they want to see. And there has been so much money poured into global warming, to studying global warming. That's where the money is. So everybody's going to say, oh, I'm a global warming expert. I want to apply my specialty field of rat feces analysis to the problems of whether the globe is getting warmer or not. And they go where the money is going to take them. It's called the golden rule of science. Whoever's got the gold makes the science. So I think the very best thing that we can say at this point is we don't know for sure. But one thing we do know for sure, from the fossil record and the geological record, the Earth is always getting colder. It's always getting warmer. In these very long, roughly 100,000-year cycles that seem to correspond with the oscillation in the shape of the Earth's actual orbit around the sun, which is not something that Al Gore or anybody else can do anything about just yet. Certainly, from the last couple of winters, it does seem that maybe we're in a cooling trend right now. And the bottom line is carbon dioxide is being villainized because that one can be laid at the feet of people in order to extract taxes from them. Water vapor is a far worse greenhouse gas. So is methane. But you can't blame those on people in order to send them a tax bill. Carbon dioxide is villainized. You know something? We need carbon dioxide. Without it, the plants don't grow. And on a planet already beset by widespread famine, we probably need as much carbon dioxide as we can crank out there so the crops will grow taller and larger and bear more food. Anyway, so that's the latest from the global warming cult. They're thinking solely in terms of being able to buy and sell these carbon tax credits and make themselves rich. They want to Enronize the world's climate is what they're trying to do, is turn it into another money-making thing. These carbon tax credits are a fictional product. They're invented out of thin air. It doesn't really exist. It is a piece of paper that you buy and sell, and you turn it into a commodity, and you make profit on it. And they've already got the system in Europe, and it's making the traders in the carbon tax credits very rich and has not improved the economy one bit. Actually, we've killed off a bunch more trees printing up all this paperwork for the carbon tax and the carbon tax credit system. So we took those trees out of the biosphere. Way to go, global warming cult. We're going to take a break here, 800-259-9231, 800-259-9231. We'll be back with the last segment of our show today after these words from our sponsor.
Can we talk?
Can we talk?
Can we talk about gun control?
Gun control?
Seems like it should work, doesn't it?
It should work.
You'd think so. Yeah.
Pass the right laws.
Pass the right laws.
And you can disarm the criminals.
You disarm them.
That's the idea.
But the problem is...
The problem?
Criminals don't obey the law.
They don't obey the law.
That's true.
After all, they're criminals.
They're criminals.
Criminals. They'll always find a way to get guns.
No matter how many laws you pass.
Which means
they still have guns.
They still have guns. While the rest of us...
The rest of us?
The rest of us are just left defenseless.
Americans who own guns, people like you and me, prevent over 1 million violent crimes every year. get the facts on gun control.
This is the GCN Radio Network.
Welcome to What Really Happened Radio. Visit us online at whatreallyhappened.com. And now, set your eyes on the future, and let's consider what really happened.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to the show here. Last segment of the show today. If you want to join us on the air, it's 800-259-9231. 800-259-9231. Got a couple of things to cover this last segment. This is just now breaking. If you will remember, back in 2008, the court system ruled that bloggers are effectively functioning as journalists in our society. This goes back to what I was talking about with the Bill Maher situation and dissing the bloggers. Apparently, the Senate has just introduced a new bill which would redefine legal protections for journalists, and hidden inside this bill is a clause that specifically excludes bloggers from being journalists. So this bill, if passed as it is, would effectively strip bloggers of any of the legal protections reporters for the corporate media now have. And I think this is another indicator that the U.S. government and the corporations are looking at the blogosphere with an incredible amount of fear, because they can't control the minds of the American people the way they used to back during the glory days of the Cold War or the Dark Ages, and we're going to get into that in a minute. And they're trying to basically shut it down. And they're going to be about as successful as the church was in preventing Gutenberg's movable type printing from putting inexpensive books into the hands of ordinary people. And they did, in fact, try. In fact, the very first person to translate the Bible into English was burned at the stake, along with his Bibles, I might add. And so we're seeing more and more of these indicators that the corporate media, their job. You know, when I go in and I do a presentation about the corporate media and the TV networks, and I say, what does television sell? And they'll say, oh, it sells shampoo, and it sells Nike shoes, and it sells... No. Television sells you. Television's one and only product is the minds of the audience watching the bait called the programs to lure them in and put them in a receptive state of mind so that the advertisers can buy those minds for the ad rates and sell them something, whether it's shoes or shampoo or a war. And for the longest time, because of propaganda and public relations or however they want to call it, the U.S. government just got into the habit of being able to convince the American people of just about anything. And I think the classic example is back at the close of World War II, when we had defeated the Germans and the Japanese. And everyone said, the war is over. It's time for peace. We can spend the money on ourselves and our homes and our schools and our hospitals. And the group of defense contractors who liked things just the way they were said, no. We've got to have a new enemy. And they went to their friends in Hollywood and said, okay, you've been making all these wonderful movies that demonize the Germans and demonize the Japanese. Now we need you to do the same thing to the Russians, because they're going to be the new enemy that we're going to wave at the American people. And we're going to make them such villains that the American people will just shovel the money into the furnace as fast as they can in order to support this new Cold War. Now, to their credit, a lot of people in Hollywood refused to do this, and they lost their careers because of it. But unfortunately, the majority of people in Hollywood said, sure, job is a job is a job is a job, just keep the money going my way. And they started making movies that demonized the Russians. And the American people got sold this lemon that the same Russians who had helped us defeat Hitler in Europe were now the enemy. And they sold that lemon to the American public because there were no dissenting voices out there with a form or a platform or a means to raise these questions about why these people who had been our friends are all of a sudden supposed to be our enemies, and that we're supposed to spend $5 trillion back then, when $1 trillion was really a lot of money, to build all these nuclear bombs and everything to wave at the Russians, to wave at the Soviets. And our government wants to go back to those glory days of the Cold War when they could say whatever they wanted to about anybody else in the world and the media would shovel it at you with a pitchfork as hard as they could and there was nobody out there to say, wait a minute, this may not be true. And they want to go back to that. And we're starting to see more and more indications. The corporate media is trying to diss and insult and discredit the blogosphere as hard as they can. And now we're seeing the government start to enact laws which will remove the legal protections that bloggers fought for and won over the last several years. It's the beginning of repression tactics from the president who promised change we could believe in. I think the change is going in the wrong direction. Now, speaking of this Cold War bludgeoning kind of thing where we tell you what you will think and we tell you what you will believe, brings us back to the case of Bishop Williamson. Bishop Williamson is one of the people who has some questions about the Orthodox telling of the Holocaust against the Jews in Germany. And I'm being specific here because World War II, there were a lot of Holocausts against a lot of people. 60 million people died in that war, most of them civilians. And there were atrocities committed by all parties on all sides. There is no question. The firebombing of Dresden was done to crush the spirit of the German people. Dresden was not a military town, did not have military factories there in any abundance. It was just a target Germans felt good about, and they just laid waste to it. Far more destruction than the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. All done with thermite incendiary bombs, just roasted the place. They're just now in Austria, they're digging up the graves of German soldiers, German POWs who were just executed on the spot. They're digging those up. War is a bad thing. We all know that. And atrocities get committed on both sides. Anyway, Bishop Williams is one of those people who has doubts about the veracity of the story that we got regarding World War II Germany and those slave labor camps. And Williamson is prudent and wise to want to ask questions, because we now all live in an age where we know the U.S. government and the media lies to us about important things. They lied to us about Saddam's nuclear weapons. They lied to us about Iraq buying uranium from Niger, Africa, the Yellowcake story. We know about the dodgy dossier and the Downing Street Minutes and all of that. So we know, we have a wisdom our parents' generation didn't have. We know the government lies to us about very important things. So the best that we can say about any of the things we've been taught in school is we don't really know for sure whether it's true or not. You know, did Lee Oswald act alone? The evidence says otherwise. Were there torpedoes in the Gulf of Tonkin? Actually, no, there weren't. Was the USS Maine blown up by a Spanish mine in Havana Harbor? Actually, no. The captain of the ship said the coal bunker exploded. We know we're lied to. So the wise and prudent course is to say, we don't know. Let's go find out. And that's what Bishop Williamson was saying. And it caused this huge uproar as people of the Jewish faith are coming over to the Catholic faith and saying, no, you've got to make them believe the way we tell them to believe, which is how crusades and inquisitions and everything start. And finally, the bishop said, look, I'm sorry I caused a ruckus. I'll shut up. And the Israelis came back and said, oh, no, that's not good enough. You must repudiate your claims and you must declare that you absolutely accept 100% the official story of the Holocaust. And now they have somehow or other, maybe they've got negatives on pedophilic priests or something, but Pope Benny has come out and said that Bishop Williamson must publicly state that he accepts the official story of the Holocaust if he is going to remain in the Catholic Church. Personally, if I were Williamson, I'd take a walk right now. Because this is a matter of principle. And the thinking, the thought process that we're seeing from Pope Benny and from the Israelis here, this is Dark Ages mentality. This is sending our society back 400 years to when truth and fact didn't matter. It was what you could beat people into believing. And that is exactly where Pope Benny is right now. Doesn't matter what the facts and evidence are. It's like the judge in the Ernst Zundel case in Germany who said in court, it doesn't matter if what you're saying is the truth, it's still illegal for you to say it. Everyone talks about the country going back into a dark ages as the American empire collapses. because the collapse of the Roman Empire triggered the Dark Ages in Europe. The collapse of the American Empire could trigger Dark Ages. I think it's already happening. When you have thinking like this, that truth is what we can beat you into believing, that's Dark Ages thinking, and I am opposed to that. That's it for our show today. We'll be back Monday with our usual mayhem at 5 o'clock Central Time. So share this show with your friends, call your local stations and tell them you want to hear us, and aloha, America.